say hello to the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, James Madison and the Making of America, and many other great works, the one and only hair doctor, Kevin Gutzman. And Kevin has been making guest appearances on this show going all the way back to the release of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution in 2007. And, of course, he was the host or the co-host of the Constitution Hour here on the Crusade Channel. And we're glad and delighted to be able to reach out again and talk to have Professor Gutzman here on the Mike Church Show. Brother Gutzman, it's been far too long, my friend. My fault, most of it. How are you?
Hello, Mike. Very well. How are you?
I am well. So what you been up to?
Oh, man. well, I'm working on another book, which is supposed to be done early next year. It's called The Virginia Dynasty, Presidents Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe. That's the one thing. Other than that, you know, the usual professor stuff.
Now, wait a minute. You graduated a daughter out of college, didn't you?
That's true, yeah. She graduated magna cum laude from the University of Oklahoma.
And,
how about that?
And is she following in Dan's footsteps? Is she going to pursue a JD?
Oh, no. I hope not.
That's good. You know, I was telling someone yesterday about, I said we were going to talk to Kevin again, and he said, make sure you ask him about Trump. I said, of course I'm going to ask him about Trump. So we only have 15 minutes, but hopefully we can get together more often again. Well, how do you rate the constitutional and judicial success or lack of the Trump administration, Kevin?
Oh, boy. Well, that's two separate questions. First, when it comes to the judiciary, you know, it's been a smashing success. The appointments have been, in general, excellent. Already the outcomes have been flipped in several ways. For example, the Ninth Circuit is no longer a circus. In fact, we've seen conservative constitutionalist outcomes even in the Ninth Circuit already, and it does seem that Justices Kagan and Sotomayor are going to be in the minority for a long time to come, so that's good. On the other hand, wow, when it comes to spending, this is just a debacle. I think if being a conservative means conserving something, it's hard to call the Trump administration conservative. It's decided that it doesn't really matter how much debt is racked up or what kind of unfunded obligations the government has. And so it's made the outlook even worse than it was before, which is kind of hard to imagine.
Now, let me follow up on the judiciary question. Do you, there's some trepidation among, quote, conservatives, close quote, about some of the things that have already been written or the opinions that have been joined by Justice Kavanaugh. If we were just talking about, not Roe, if we were talking about Casey, which I think is the linchpin of most of this when it comes to abortion, if we were just talking about Casey, do you think Justice Kavanaugh is in a majority to look at it again or to maybe even to overturn it?
I don't think Roberts would do that unless there were six votes. So I think that's really probably a moot question. I don't think they're going to grant cert to a case directing or taking that question up at this point. But Kavanaugh, well, when his nomination was pending, he apparently told senators that, of course, it was an important precedent. And people immediately said, well, this means he wouldn't vote to overturn it. And I took that to be just a kind of tautology. You know, it's an important precedent.
Right.
That doesn't commit him to anything. So one can be hopeful. Certainly his statements about his understanding of the Constitution going back as far as they've been recorded have all indicated that he was some kind of originalist or something. So I think that he's going to be a vote in favor of getting rid of it if cert were granted. That is, if the court decided to take the case. That it's not as obvious as Gorsuch or Thomas, but yeah, I think he's a good appointment. it's certainly an improvement over the guy he replaced.
Now, what do you what about Justice Gorsuch? I think he's been a very pleasant surprise, don't you? Or good, or he's been very pleasantly good.
I think he has been good. I think his statements about precedent, his general outlook, his skepticism about federal authority vis-a-vis the states, all have been good. I don't know what more you could want. So, yeah, I'm happy with him.
Now, let me go to something that was said the other day, and you and I have been talking about this for, 13 years now, about Congress's responsibility or their authority when it comes to the judiciary. If there is a check, well, then Congress has it. Did you see this story the other day where I think it was Pelosi or one of her lieutenants said that if Trump thinks he's going to get the nominated replacement for the aged Darth Vader Ginsburg, then Congress is going to have to look at adjusting the court or something to that effect. Did you see this or hear it?
Well, there has been talk among left-wing academics of expanding the court to undo a new conservative majority if one is a product of the Trump administration. And on one hand, I wish they wouldn't do that. And on the other hand, of course, as you and I have said for years and years, that's entirely within Congress's discretion. If Congress wants to respond to misbehavior by federal judges by, creating new judicial posts, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. That is one of the checks on judicial behavior that the Constitution gives to Congress. Of course, apparently what leftists are worried about is that that federal courts will cease to misbehave in the way we've become accustomed to. And of course, you and I have wished they would cease to misbehave forever.
Forever.
So, yeah. So, it's Pelosi, so
right.
She's a special kind of creature, pro-abortion Catholic, whatever that is. So, I don't know. I don't know what to expect of her.
Well, I'm sure that for at least a moment, because I said this on the show and I even mentioned you, I said for a moment I went, in all actual reality, I'm actually encouraged that Ms. Pelosi and some other members of our party actually have come to the realization that they have some authority over the judiciary. It's about high time, isn't it?
Right. 8 decades have been long enough.
Hey, 8 decades. You're hearing the voice of Dr. Professor Kevin Gutzman, author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, James Madison and the Making of America. I think we have one signed copy of James Madison left. And Thomas, what's the title of the Jefferson book again?
Thomas Jefferson, Revolutionary.
Revolutionary. So a book on TJ. And as he said, he's working on a book on the Virginia dynasty. Just quickly, because I know we only had 15 minutes. In the dynasty book, because wasn't Governor Tyler, wouldn't he have been the last of the Virginians to be president, right?
Well, actually, depending how you count, Woodrow Wilson was from Virginia, too. But what my book is about is the three consecutive Virginia presidencies, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. There have been two times in American history we've had three straight two-term presidents. One was Clinton, W., and Obama. The other one was Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe.
Wow. Didn't know that.
And while Clinton, W., and Obama were three different kinds of animals, kind of moderate Democrat, a neoconservative Republican, and a left-wing Democrat, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe were all the same in their outlook and in their program. And in fact, they regarded the three presidencies as one continuous administration. So I think it's about time somebody did a study, and that's what I'm working on at the moment.
Can't wait to read it. A question that came in from a listener yesterday. I know you saw this on Twitter. We've been talking about this. The Democrats' obsessive desire to get rid of anything that remains of the Electoral College. Of course, there is this case where the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has decided that Colorado's Electoral College electors aren't required to cast their vote for the presidential candidate who wins the most votes in their state. I already know what you have to say about it, but I can't wait for you to say it. So why don't you tell us what you think about this, constitutionally speaking?
Well, Article 1 of the Constitution says that the electoral votes of the states will be cast in whatever way the state legislatures determine. So the idea that state legislatures can't determine that their electors will vote for particular people is absurd. All the way back to George Washington, it's been the case that they've done that. In fact, when Washington was elected the first time in 1789, most of the state legislatures just passed laws saying our electors are going to vote for George Washington. They didn't have any kind of popular vote or anything else. So this is ridiculous. And, of course, that doesn't mean that ultimately it won't survive in our contemporary political system, but it shouldn't. It's supposed to be entirely at the legislature's discretion. In fact, not only did the majority of states' legislatures just say we're going to vote for George Washington in 1789, but South Carolina never had a popular vote for president until 1868. So this is craziness, but it's what we've come to expect out of our contemporary judicial intellectual system. And wow, left-wing legislators are totally bereft of understanding of the Constitution.
You know, it's funny, they we have to have democracy, the voice of the people. If a president, someone is democratically elected, end of story, then they get the position, unless it's a Blessed or St. Francis Xavier Cabrini, and it's for a statue to be put up for women who helped make the state of New York great, and she's in competition against two men who weren't women. And then the mayor's wife of New York City says, yeah, we don't want the people that actually won, Dorothy Day and Francis Cabrini. We want these cross dressers, these transvestites, if you will, to be on school on the corner so the school children can admire them. All right, we only got 2 minutes left. Tell us about this paper that was discovered in the hand of John Locke, I guess, which had not previously been discovered, and what's in it.
Apparently it's a kind of preliminary consideration of what later became Locke's essay concerning his first essay on religious toleration. And what he's asking is the question whether Catholics should be tolerated in Protestant England. And, of course, his conclusion is, well, yes, they should, which you might think is just not even controversial, but if you lived in England in Locke's day, Catholics were under severe legal disabilities. So, for example, if you were a Catholic, you could not be in the House of Commons, you could not be in the House of Lords, you could not go to Oxford or Cambridge, and so on. And Locke says, well, this shouldn't be, because people have a natural right to follow their own consciences in this regard. And so this, of course, ultimately Locke is going to lead to Locke writing a more general essay concerning religious toleration. And the reason that's really significant in America is because it's one of the main influences on Thomas Jefferson's thinking about these questions. And, of course, we know that he and his friend James Madison have a leading role in establishing this idea of toleration as a basic American political principle. So this is really kind of spectacular. The library in which it was located doesn't have a single other thing in Locke's hand. This unknown essay is the entire Locke manuscript collection in that library, and there it is. Wow. Nobody even knew that there was such an essay by Locke.
Incredible. I don't know if you'd seen this, but I only noticed because I edited a book and republished it called The English Reformation. The oldest surviving portrait of one Henry VIII that was painted from life, in other words, he sat for it, was discovered around 1908, 1909, somewhere in there, in similar condition. It was in a collection of things about Henry VIII that had been put in a folio, you know, one of those big flat drawers, had been put in like a folio drawer, and somebody said, hey, we need to catalog that drawer. And they were cataloging the drawer, And they come across this very heavy canvas with a lot of paint on it. They take it out and they hang it up and they go like, that's Henry VIII. And it turns out now it's hanging in some museum in London. It is the oldest portrait painted from, there's a very young Henry of King Henry VIII. So maybe there's a lot more to be discovered in folios over there, huh?
You know, the thing about European repositories is they're just sitting there. People never look at them.
That's right.
It really is kind of amazing. So if you're buried in history, then you just don't pay attention to any of it. I actually came of age in Texas where there aren't many historical buildings, there aren't many historical sites. And then when I was in graduate school at UVA in Virginia, of course, I was just perplexed by the fact that in Virginia, because there's so many historic sites and there's so many historic buildings and so on, then they don't pay attention to any of them. There aren't any markers. It doesn't seem that the state government maintains them. I found it totally different. It's an opposite problem from Texas problem.
Well, maybe someday, right? Final question before you go, because I have been a lifelong follower of James Monroe. In your research for the upcoming book, anything that stands out that was not previously disclosed about President James, about President Monroe, or some of the things that he did that you'll include in the book? I'm just curious.
Well, the most interesting thing about him I've found so far is in the aftermath of Gabriel's Rebellion in Virginia in 1800. So basically what's going on in 1800 is that John Adams is president, the Republican opposition led by Jefferson and Madison defeats him in the election in 1800, and so Jefferson is going to be the next president. And while this is going on, in the area around Richmond and all the way down to Williamsburg on the coast in Virginia occurs the biggest slave insurrection scare ever in the history of the United States. And the fellow who's at the middle of it, Gabriel Prosser, he's usually been called because Prosser was his master's name, said that there were as many as 1,000 men prepared to participate in this uprising. And so we end up with a conversation or an extended correspondence between Vice President Jefferson and Governor Monroe over what to do with the captive participants. And finally, at one point, Monroe and Jefferson agree, well, you know, these slave men didn't do anything morally wrong. There's nothing wrong with it. So on one hand, we have slavery. We have to enforce it because it would be dangerous for the majority population if we just said, okay, you're slave rebels. You didn't do anything wrong. We're going to let you go and nothing's going to happen. We have to do something. On the other hand, they say they didn't do anything morally wrong. So we should put an end to hanging people for being slave rebels, and maybe we could take the people we've got in captivity who are going to be punished for being in on this plot and just send them out of Virginia. And so you have the editor of Monroe's paper says this is the first time on record that Monroe says he wished slavery in Virginia would be abolished, and yet here he is having to, you know, send these people away, or there had been hangings in Richmond, and it's really a pretty grim scenario. So you end up with Monroe and Matt and Jefferson agreeing that there needs to be an end to Virginia slavery. And of course, one result of this is going to be that when Monroe becomes president 17 years later, he's going to take the lead in sponsoring the establishment of the West African country of Liberia, whose original settlers were free blacks from the United States. So they both, Jefferson and Monroe, both hoped that eventually slavery would be ended in Virginia and the slaves would be sent somewhere else. And one of the ideas was, well, how about West Africa? So it, to me, I'm reading this and I'm thinking, wow, you never hear about this. And what a terrible position. Imagine you're the governor of Virginia and you don't like slavery. You think it's immoral, but if there's a slave rebellion, you can't just say, well, okay, slave rebellions are all right. We're not going to do anything about them. Because obviously the goal of a slave rebellion is to kill a bunch of people. Can't have that. So you might think, well, he could say, well, I want to end slavery, and he does want to end slavery, but he knows the legislature won't do it. So then what do you do?
What do you do? Well,
yeah, what do you do?
You buy Gutzman's book and find out how it turns out.
There you go. Yes.
Hey, is this one coming out just in time for Valentine's Day gifts?
I'm afraid you're still going to have to rely on the loving splendors of James Madison for Valentine's Day.
Oh, inside joke and old story. All right, Kevin, you said 15, you gave me 19. Always grateful for your time. Hope to talk to you again real soon.
Nice talking to you, Mike.